passage to were not likely to get through bone. And bone and cartilage are assignments in lab this week, so we'll try to get as much into bone as we can so you get a little, little appreciation of its general appearance. But we have a lot to do. And thank goodness we've talked a little bit about connective tissue already. We're going to deal with the soft connective tissue first. That's sometimes called connective tissue proper. I don't know why. And then we'll start the hard connective tissue, or firm connective tissue, cartilage and bone. This introductory slide shows a structure, the arrow was pointing at it there, a structure called the collagen fibril. And you've probably encountered this term fibril before. Let me just say a little bit more about it. In histology, and in growth anatomy too, but primarily histology, fibrils are considered subunits of the big object, fiber. So the convention is, whenever you see the IL on the end, it means a little one of something. And so it's a subunit of the bigger fiber. We're going to talk about collagen fibers today. And we're going to talk about these up here, collagen fibrils. Now, if these are subunits of a fiber, then my prediction would be that as we look at these fibrils, then my prediction is that a fiber runs all the way across. That's the fiber contained within the yellow line, and the subunits are the fibrils. You cannot see fibrils with the light microscope. They are exclusively seen with the electron microscope. But it's important to understand where they fit into the scheme of things. And the way they fit is that fibrils are made up of collagen molecules. And now we're getting down to biochemistry. Clearly, there's no microscope in the world that can see collagen molecules. They're way too small. They're in the realm of biochemistry. But when they aggregate together, they form something we can see. And of course, the fibrils aggregate together to form the object that you see in the laboratory as a collagen fiber. So we're going to work on that here as we move along. We have talked about this material already. Any questions about the definition of connective tissue and its functions? Composition being cells and extracellular materials. We change this word down here to ground substance. Ground substance. Yeah, okay, we'll do it again. General functions are diverse. And it is complicated in the sense that there are far more functions than found in epithelial cells. But the general functions are simply connect. And in other words, it's our connective tissue that lives in the tissue stage that makes the stomach look like the stomach, and the spleen look like the spleen, and the liver look like the liver, and so forth and so on. Because connective tissue in the tissue stage maintains form, shape, support, scaffolding, infrastructure, whatever word you want to use, to maintain that shape. And so that's primarily the general function, but we have some connective tissues that are specialized, like fat. We don't think of fat as being important in holding all of our cells together, energy storage. Here's another interesting connective tissue, blood. Well, you say, well, blood tissue space. Where is blood normally found? In the blood vessels. Remember, that's not in the tissue space. Now, outside of the blood vessels is the tissue space. And why is blood connective tissue? Well, there's debate. Why do you think it's called connective tissue? Somebody?
Because it carries things from your body. Connects blood and everything.
Well, there are reasons to suspect that it moves around and it's mostly extracellular stuff. There are characteristics like that. Yeah, that's another way of saying it. Connective tissue is characterized by more extracellular material than cellular. And in fact, there's more plasma than there are cells. And they move around a lot, but I think the best, and it's debatable, the best reason why blood is considered among the connective tissue is that it's made in bone marrow. In bone marrow is connective tissue. And so it's sort of like these endocrine glands. Why would you ever refer to an endocrine gland as epithelium? They don't make contact with the blood directly. They don't make contact with the outside world, so it violates our rule. But endocrine glands are considered epithelial cells because they want to make contact with the outside world. Blood once was in the connective tissue when it was made. So that's stretching the rule pretty thinly. But anyway, those are some specialized connective tissue. Let's name one more. One that you love. Our immune system is made up of connective tissue cells. Does it connect anything? No. Does it hold anything together? No. So those are kind of specialized functions of connective tissue. Any other questions about this slide? Okay, be aware that we're going to talk about extracellular materials in our discussion first. Those are the first slides that come along. And then we'll identify some of the most important cells. Let me repeat again that one of the characteristics of connective tissue is that we have much more non-living extracellular material in it than we do cells. How about epithelium? How much extracellular stuff is there in epithelium? Practically nothing. The cells are touching, and squeezing out all of the extracellular stuff. We looked at this. We said that the collagen fiber, big baby, the big ones, are the big, here blue, but you'll see them as pink. And the elastic fibers are the thin black fibers here. And look how they seem to branch. And it is true that elastic fibers branch. Collagen fibers don't do much of that, ever. Except maybe in some other, some special tissues. And the cells are peppered in and around the fibers. And what's the white stuff? What's the empty space? Ground substance. And we're going to look at ground substance first, actually. There's another view of this. Collagen fibers labeled. Elastic fibers labeled. We need to know, or you need to know, a little bit about the properties. The biological properties differ between collagen and elastic fibers, and it's inherent in, at least in one of their names. The elastic fibers tell you pretty much what their biological properties include. And the most important cell of the many cells that we're going to encounter here are the ones that are having a good time. They're having a blast. They're having a good time, and they're making all the fibers, and they're making all the ground substance. And they're having a good time doing it. And this is young connective tissue, and the fibroblasts have just formed, but it's now time for them to make fibers, and we don't see too many fibers yet. It's young infant connective tissue. Embryological origin, we said, was from the mesoderm. Please read page 147 if you haven't had embryology class. If you haven't had any embryology physiology, mesoderm is one of the layers of the embryo that forms during the third week of pregnancy or the third week of gestation. And it forms almost all of our connective tissue, except for some connective tissue that's found in our head, which is not made from mesoderm. Well, this embryonic layer makes more than connective tissue. It makes muscle, skeletal muscle, and it makes some blood vessel, things like that. And so we want to think about the specific derivative of this embryonic germ layer that makes connective tissue. And that derivative of mesoderm is called mesenchyme. And we're going to talk about mesenchymal cells in you and I because we have some cells that are primitive. One of the characteristics of mesenchymal cells, we don't have too many of them because they were primarily present when we were in the uterus. But they are a form of, and you know this word very, very well, don't you? Because you've heard it on the radio and the newspaper all the time. They're a form of stem cell that we have in our body that has potential. Mesenchyme cells are a form of stem cell that have the potential to multiply and differentiate into a lot of different kinds of cells. And I got a slide here coming up that'll show you some of the offspring of these stem cells. Clearly, the extracellular material has a lot of tissue fluid in it, and it's the fluid part of the tissue space. It's the fluid part of connective tissue. And yesterday, we looked at how tissue fluid forms. Hydrostatic pressure forces the fluid out of the arterial end of the capillary, and then the tissue fluid returns at the venous end, and some of it is picked up by lymphatics. One of the last slides we looked at yesterday was this circulation between blood and tissue space. This is the fluid we're talking about. It has all of these goodies and waste material deposited in it, the locations in the tissue space. Its composition is water and any kind of imaginable nutrient you can think of. Any imaginable waste material like carbon dioxide is in there. Sodium, potassium. I think in physiology class you're going to hear a slight variation to this term. And it becomes an important concept in physiology. And Harold can refer to that as interstitial fluid. Same stuff. Interstitial fluid. With a slight difference maybe, but only slight. Formation is from the blood and from cells as well. It's absorbed, as we saw right here, into the capillaries by osmotic pressure. It's formed by hydrostatic pressure mainly, but cells up here also contribute to that fluid. Depends upon the total water content of the person. And of course, lymphatics. Lymphatic vessels are also present to complete that normal process there. Here's some mesenchyme. It's very blah. But what's most important in connective tissue is you do not see in connective tissue these cells all lined up in colonies and in membranes and in glands, because that's epithelium. Here you can see the cells, and they don't look like they're anywhere near each other. They have long processes, though, and you can see out of focus, terribly out of focus, a process here, and a long arm here, and a long arm here, and one here. So they have some cytoplasm around their nucleus, but these mesenchymal cells have long cytoplasm projections that oftentimes touch other cells that you can't see. An arm from one cell may touch an arm from another cell. What are we looking at right here? what's that branch tube there? What is that? A capillary? What does it have in it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 little objects in it. What are they? Red blood cells. Red blood cells inside a capillary. And this this cell right here, what do you think that might be? Is that a mesenchymal cell like this one? Or what do you think about that cell right there? What is that cell? It's lining the wall of a blood vessel. It's making contact with the blood. It slats. Somebody sat on it. What do you think? Simple squamous epithelium. Right. Now, those simple squamous epithelial cells lining that blood vessel, boy, don't they look like this one? That's flat. That's sat on. But that's a fibroblast in the connective tissue. You see, the appearances can be similar. Why would you not call that cell an epithelial cell? Yeah, it's not contacting any white space. It's not making contact with any outside world, and it's not making contact with any blood. Therefore, not epithelial. Very hard and fast rule, isn't it? Hard and fast rule. Here's our embryonic or adult mesenchymal cell. We don't have too many of these. It's a stem cell. When it divides, when necessary, it can make, after the division, by differentiation, it can make some bone cells. Here's a couple of bone cells. It can become a general run-of-the-mill fibroblast. It could divide to form a fat cell, adipose cell. It could divide to become a couple of different cartilage cells. Bone cells far left, cartilage cells far right. And this is just a small sample of the progeny of this stem cell here. Here's an endothelial cell of a blood vessel. Well, it's derived from a mesenchymal cell, but it's derived from a mesenchymal cell, but is that cell a connective tissue cell? My question is, define endothelium for me. The simple squamous epithelial cell that forms the lining of blood vessel. So, that endothelial cell was, in fact, this cell right here. Lining this blood vessel right there. So here's seemingly an exception, but not really. A mesoderm does form some epithelium too. So here's a mesenchymal cell that normally forms connective tissue, but here in this sense it also makes endothelial cells. Most of our endothelial cells, but not all. Okay, so the point being that stem cells can become a lot of different things, connective tissue cells and possibly epithelial cells. Let's work on extracellular materials. I think we looked at this slide too. This ground substance, amorphous ground substance, is primarily, but not exclusively, primarily composed of two major types of substances that you'll be studying in biochemistry, I'm sure. And they go by the name of glycoprotein hosts. Remember the CDS on the end? There's various forms of glycoproteins and proteoglycans. Let's use our knowledge of medical terminology to figure out if we know anything about either of these substances. Well, the stem of number one there. The stem of that word is what word? Stem of the word is the major part of the word. The stem of the word is what? Protein. So way you think the major component of the substance then is, if the stem of the word is protein. Mostly protein. What else would this substance have besides protein? What tells you that it's going to have sugar in it? Glyco. So this is a sugar protein. The stem of the word, the most important part of the word, tells you what the major component of that substance is. Using that scheme, tell me what you know about proteoglycans then. Mostly what? Mostly sugar. And it's got a little bit of protein in it. Right. And so that's what you're going to expect to see now in these diagrams, these symbolic diagrams of these substances. Histology uses symbolic diagrams, and I guess biochemistry a little more sophisticated symbolic diagrams. They see much more structure for these in biochemistry class. We're going to look at some specific examples of both of these, so hold up a little bit on that. We're going to talk about fibers, and we did identify the two main types, collagen and elastic, but we also have to add this reticular fiber to it. It's a little anomalous because, in fact, reticular fibers are composed of collagen. Reticular fibers are composed of the collagen that we saw on the first slide. This fiber going from left to right, running from here to here, was in fact a reticular fiber. Now, collagen fibers are also composed of this, and so the confusion is, what's the difference between a collagen fiber and a reticular fiber? Two different names. They both contain collagen fibrils. Well, in fact, collagen fibers have much bigger fibrils in them. And reticular fibers contain a whole lot more CHO, a whole lot more carbohydrate. In fact, if you've already studied this in the lab, and I'm sure many of you have, you can only see reticular fibers if you stain the glycoprotein and proteoglycan component of the fiber. Reticular fibers can only be seen by using a special stain, like a stain containing silver stain, and there's other stains as well, but most of the stains for reticular fibers will contain silver or some other heavy metal. Otherwise, you cannot see them, and otherwise you do not know whether it's a collagen fiber or a reticular fiber. In other words, they're very close, very similar. The reticular fiber has a lot more carbohydrate in it, and it requires a special stain. That's why in lab, you were asked to look at two different slides of the lymph node. And one of the slides was stained for reticular fibers, and you saw them, and you drew the kinky little black lines, didn't you? Those kinky little black hairs. And then you were asked to look at the other lymph node slide, and we didn't tell you what was going on, did we? We said, find the reticular fibers. On that other lymph node slide, you were comparing the two of them. Why couldn't you see the reticular fibers on that other lymph node slide? So the one stained for reticular fibers didn't have any silver stain on it.
Okay.
Very, very naive, sort of, but it does represent the difference between the two. Proteoglycans in our connective tissue, in the amorphous ground substance, generally have the protein molecule of the proteoglycan running right down the center of the molecule. That's the protein. And the carbohydrates radiate out from those from that protein core like bicycle spokes, like the spokes on a wheel. And you see every little black line here, little thin black line radiating from the central axis is one very special type of carbohydrate. Tell me what you may have encountered in life that reminds you of the structure of proteoglycan. What?
Horsetail.
Excellent. Horsetail, yeah, that's good.
Car wash.
What is it?
Car wash. Brushes on a car wash.
Brushes on a car wash, yeah. Anybody ever work in a chemistry lab and clean out graduated cylinders? Did you what you say?
Bottle brush.
Bottle brush.
Oh, mascara.
Bottle brush.
Oh, yeah.
Mascara, yeah, that's good too. Now, all of that stuff will help you remember, won't it? The structure of a proteoglycan molecule. Pretty soon we're going to look at when they aggregate together. When you have many of these proteoglycans united together, we call them proteoglycan, and to make it simple, we'll call it proteoglycan aggregates. And what links proteoglycan aggregates to a single unit is hyaluronic acid. Hyaluronic acid, I'm sure you've heard of many times in the past. It is a very large molecule that will link together many of those individual monomers.
Did you say what proteoglycan aggregates are? Those
are thousands of those linked together. Thousands on thousands, forming molecular weights over a million. Over a million easily. Now, the glycoprotein structure is extremely variable. This one is not very variable. So we don't really know how to illustrate a glycoprotein structure except to show you that there's, in one type, there's the protein, and up here is the sugar, the glycoprotein. That's kind of a useless diagram because glycoproteins have so many different tertiary structures to them. But the proteoglycans, pretty reliable, pretty dependable. Well, these little black lines here, I labeled one of them for you there, and you could see them radiating out like that bottle brush structure or the mascara brush, whatever. What are they made of? Well, like we said, they're carbohydrate, but those little black lines in the proteoglycan are made of substances that you'll study later called glycosaminoglycans. When I was a student, they were called mucopolysaccharides. And why am I talking about history? Because I'm old and feeble, do you think? And no. It's because you're going to unfortunately encounter that term in pathology where we talk about mucopolysaccharide diseases. See, the pathologists are old and feeble. They can't keep up. The new word is glycosaminoglycan. Now, I can understand that that might be hard to say, but it's much easier to abbreviate because all we have to say is that proteoglycan carbohydrates contain GAGs, glycosaminoglycans. Much easier. You know, I hate all these abbreviations, because whenever I read emails now, I don't know what the hell they're saying, because there's all these abbreviations for everything, you know. But here's a good one. gags. Gags are composed of repeating disaccharides. Haven't studied that much yet, have you, in biochemistry? And these disaccharides, meaning two sugar-containing molecules, contain hexuronic acid and hexosamine. I'm not going to test you on that. You'll be tested on biochemistry. All I'm trying to get at here is that every glycosaminoglycan is composed of repeating disaccharides, a long chain like a pearl necklace. Each pearl would consist of a disaccharide. So these long black lines we saw radiating outward from the protein core are polymers of disaccharides. So here's a disaccharide there. One of the little blue balls is a hexuronic acid, another hexosamine. And then there's the next disaccharide, and there's the next disaccharide. You get the idea. These lines represent strings of disaccharide molecules. And you have encountered some of these terms before. Like hyaluronic acid, for example, a gag, a very important one, contains a substance called glucosamine. And hyaluronic acid is a polymer of these disaccharides. We can find it in the umbilical cord of a newborn baby. It's found in your synovial fluid, and of course it's found in heavy concentration in cartilage, making up proteoglycan aggregates. Cartilage has the greatest concentration of proteoglycan aggregates of any place in the body. Bone has a little, very tiny. Cartilage is loaded. Let's go to another one here. There we go. Chondroitin 4 sulfate, chondroitin 6 sulfate. How about this one? Heparin sulfate, proteoglycan. Heparin sulfate, proteoglycan. Here's the protein core, and here's the heparin sulfate molecules. Where are you going to find that heparin sulfate, proteoglycan, from yesterday's lecture? Called perlecan. Where do you find perlecan? Basement membrane. And what is heparin sulfate linked together in proteoglycan? What function does heparin sulfate proteoglycan provide for you? Why are you not puffy and edematous?
Negative charge.
It's a negative charge. It forms a negative charge in all our basement membrane, providing this important barrier function to basement membrane. Heparin sulfate proteoglycan we talked about yesterday has a structure in basement membranes. And there's other ones here which you'll encounter other places in this curriculum. How about this one? Does anybody know anything about chondroitin? Anybody know anything about glucosamine? Yeah, well, how do you take it? Orally, anyway. Is it a liquid? Pill form. Where would you find it? In a bottle. And where would that bottle be? On a shelf. And where would that shelf be? In your kitchen? Maybe. In my kitchen. But where would you buy it? Name a store. Yeah, Seattle. Super Supplements. How's that one? Or in the hallway out here. Chondroitin and glucosamine. Why do they take it? Why does anybody take it? Because proteoglycans are found in what part of a joint? Yeah, and what's the histological substance in the joint that contains huge proteoglycan aggregates of chondroitin sulfate? Proteoglycan aggregates in cartilage. Joints, yes. Absolutely. But let's be specific. What part of the joint? The cartilage in the joint. And this chondroitin and glucosamine are the precursors, aren't they? For important things that keep your joints healthy and well. And it does help in some individuals that have a risk of developing osteoarthritis. So there's a reason, isn't there, to develop some understanding of this. And here's a proteoglycan molecule, proteoglycan, not the aggregate, just the molecule. And this happens to be the form that's found in cartilage. And notice all of the chondroitin sulfates on that proteoglycan. Notice monomer now, it's not an aggregate, it's just the one. To have an aggregate, you'd have to have literally thousands of these. I'm not so concerned about you knowing the names of all these different proteoglycans. One of the most important things is to know of their presence in cartilage because of the function that they endow to the cartilage that keeps us healthy and well. So I'm not too concerned. And maybe the reason I'm not too concerned is like I can't remember them. It's sort of like you guys. But I'm working on it. I'm working on that. So I can't remember names very well. Never forget faces. And where's the face in this picture? There is the face. That's what I see. Can't remember whether it's John, Lucy, or Sally, but I remember a face forever. And that's the face right there of that proteoglycan. Okay, so the point here is that there's all kinds of different types of proteoglycans that vary depending upon what the protein is and what the proportion of glycosaminoglycans are, what the proportion of these things are. Don't worry about all the details. I don't pick out something on a chart like this and ask you a question on it. Let's look at cartilage briefly. In cartilage, these proteoglycan monomers are all linked together by a little chain of hyaluronic acid. So the hyaluronic acid is this long line, which I can't draw very straight. There. That's a hyaluronic acid molecule. And linked to that hyaluronic acid molecule are all these bottle brushes or mascara brushes or whatever. And it does require this little ball right there to link them together, and that's called the link protein, isn't it? Requires that little extra little ball there, which links the... So that's the main parts, the hyaluronic acid, proteoglycan, and then the other linker. The reason why we're talking maybe about this linker is because for some strange reason, these link proteins become antigenic and can initiate an immune reaction, an autoimmune reaction that can destroy cartilage. So it's probably worth talking about, even though it seems to be relatively insignificant. Notice that the collagen fibrils in cartilage run in all different directions. The collagen fibrils in cartilage don't line up side by side like we saw in the very first picture. Remember, the very first slide in this connective tissue had collagen fibrils all lining up side by side, parallel to one another. And we said that if you take all the fibrils together and bundle them up, what structure is this?
Fiber.
And that's what you can see, it's a fiber. Well, we can't see fibers in cartilage because the fibrils don't line up side by side. Cartilage is made up of a lot of collagen fibrils, but you cannot see a fiber because the tiny little fibrils don't cooperate. They don't line up side by side to form a mass, a fiber. here are some drawings representing some important glycoproteins.
So why don't, what is the purpose of them not lining up?
Well, apparently the purpose of them not lining up is to provide much more room for the proteoglycan aggregates. If we have them packed tight together, then there isn't much room for this extremely functional thing. We might as well mention it now, so it'll help when we get to cartilage. The hyaluronic acid and the proteoglycan aggregates, these big, big, multi-million atomic weight molecules, bind water molecules. And so in cartilage, we have both free water, meaning each of us can move around freely in this room, or bound water, in which case I bind them together with a rope. Bound water, sort of. In other words, they're not free to move around. So we have bound water and we have free water. Well, these proteoglycan aggregates bind water. Can you think of any advantage of having cartilage full of water?
Shock.
Shock, yes, shock absorbers, hydraulic shock absorbers. And I'm going to test that theory right now. What happened to my spine? Bones in my spine, why didn't they crush together and smash and hurt me? Because the intervertebral cartilage discs are shock absorbers full of water. What happens when we age? Water decreases in the proteoglycan because of modification of proteoglycan aggregates. The water content decreases, and there's much less shock absorber protection. Of course, I was also testing the cartilage in my knees, my joints, too, by doing that. And thank goodness for my proteoglycan aggregates, my chondroitin sulfate, my glucosamine, and all the rest of that. Thank the Lord for these things that keep me well at my age of 45. Yeah, right, you believe that. I was 45 once. Anyway, this illustrates two glycoproteins that are supremely important as well. And these glycoproteins illustrated here and some like it, have been referred to rather effectively, I think, in the past, as adhesive glycoproteins. The problem I had, and you might have, with understanding glycoproteins is that there's no reliable structure memorize, like proteoglycan. They're all bottle brushes. But here, see, there's a tremendous variation in the molecular structure. Many of the ones we're going to talk about have adhesive properties which help to hold structures together in a connective tissue, help to hold cells to fibers, and fibers to fibers, and so forth and so on. They have adhesive properties. It may not be the best term to use if you want to think at the molecular level and covalent bonding and all that, but it's useful in the sense it gives a sense of what their functions are. For example, laminin can adhere to type 4 collagen. Laminin can adhere to heparin sulfate proteoglycan. Laminin can adhere to the cell membrane. Boy, that's a great example of an adhesive glycoprotein because it helps adhere, a cell to the extracellular world, even to basement membrane. So laminin is an adjunct to heavy desmosomes in an epithelium to help bind things together. Fibronectin, people have lost interest in studying it anymore, although there still are laboratories that specialize in studying fibronectin. question. One of the reasons, I guess, is if you look at the term, you can come up with a fiber glue, something that glues fibers together. Well, that was proven to be the case, but fibronectin has a lot of other properties as well. For example, you may have heard that if you cut off the arm of a salamander, newt, what happens to that arm? Grows back. Well, right at the end of that growing limb, right at the very tip of that growing limb, is a layer of fibronectin which is leading the way. And without that fibronectin found there, that limb will not regenerate. It turns out that fibronectin has been studied in cancer because you can take cancer cells, some cancer cells in culture, and cover them with fibronectin, and they revert to their normal phenotype, their normal shape. Now, that's just very, very special kinds of cancer cells. So it turned out to be not a useful intervention. Fibronectin is ubiquitous throughout the body, throughout the connective tissue, and it is one of our adhesive glycoproteins, and it helps to link things together. So when you look at the diagrams in Ross or any other textbook, you'll see once in a while pictures where fibronectin is labeled as kind of an intermediate strut between one thing and another. Notice the disulfide bonds down here, which become relevant in biochemistry. Laminin is one of the first substances produced embryonically when an epithelium has formed. And here the laminin is stained a yellow-brown. And a special technique, immunoperoxidase technique, has been used to stain the early appearance of a basal lamina, but not just the laminin component and nothing else. And you see, fat cells have basal lamina around them too. And capillaries, of course, have a basal lamina. There's a little nerve down here. Well, that's the second half of the quarter. A little nerve there and a little nerve here. That has a basal lamina around it, too. Here's the fibronectin. We can also stain for fibronectin. You see the difference between laminin distribution and fibronectin. Laminin is heavily concentrated in basal lamina. But fibronectin, also brown here, is everywhere. It's everywhere. And it's tying things together in the connective tissue. What are these fibronectins and laminins, or glycoproteins? And they're part of the amorphous ground substance of connective tissue. Let's look at the fibers. Get away from the ground substance now. Get away from the stuff you can't see. Now we're going to see this. Collagen. Collagen fibers remind me of little stainless steel wires in terms of their function. When you stretch a stainless steel wire, will it stretch? Not really, not much. Has a high tensile strength, meaning it can't be stretched very much. High tensile strength. Let's spell that word, tensile. High tensile strength, meaning it can't be pulled, like the spider web, right? Very high strength fiber. And that's why when you treat collagen with tannic acid, you produce a high-strength material that they make shoes and baseball covers and belts. Leather. Collagen is transformed to leather because it has the fibers that have high tensile strength, as opposed to elastic fibers. What happens when you pull them? They stretch. What happens when you let them go? They recoil. Which of those is the elastic property, the stretch, or the of that computer. You think about elastic fibers in Joann's fabric store. Why, you think they're elastic fibers because they stretch. Well, that's okay if you're a seamstress. However, elastic properties in human biology refers to the fact that these fibers recoil, not that they stretch. That becomes an important difference. This is it depends on what group you're talking to, I guess. If you're in the fabric industry, then that's elastic properties. In human physiology, this is elastic. A recoil, not the stretch, a recoil. And so elastic fibers have great recoil abilities to them. Collagen fibers do not stretch very much, but they have some stretch and they have a huge recoil. So that paradoxically, they also have a high elastic coefficient.
Is there a term for stretching?
Not really. In physiology, stretching. They do have a high elastic property too, because they can stretch just a smidgen, and when you let them go, bang. Now, what happens in the lung? When the lung has all these wonderful elastic fibers, the lung fills with air. I'm going to fill them now. And when the elastic fibers recoil, I breathe out. There's no muscles that force air out of your lungs except at high respiratory rates. The diaphragm contracts, air moves in. The elastic fibers recoil, air moves out. Diaphragm contracts, air moves in. Elastic fibers recoil, air moves out. It's a simple process, isn't it? Well, the lung can lose its elastic fibers and develop more collagen fibers. So the lung now doesn't inflate and stretch very well. But when they exhale, boom, the air goes out in 1 second. Bang, there's a high elastic recoil. Collagen. Confusing, maybe. Okay, so collagen fibers are made up of subunits of fibrils, and the molecules, the collagen molecules form the fibrils, and the fibrils form the fibers. Smallest units of molecule. Next unit of increased size is the fibro, and then the largest is the fiber. We're not going to worry about the sizes of fibers. This becomes an important part of our discussion in histology because we can visualize it with a microscope. Unfortunately, not your microscope, but we can see it with a microscope. We'll look at this slide and we'll take a break. When I was a student, only four types of collagen molecules have been discovered. And so they were called collagen type 1, collagen type 2, collagen type 3, collagen type 4. What would make them different? Why? What in collagen 1 makes it different than collagen 4, do you think, in a general sense? Not the properties. Well, it's properties, yes, but more importantly, the structure. And the structure of what? The polypeptide chains. Remember the transcription-translation process? Where one amino acid is linked together with another amino acid, and you have the primary structure of a protein is amino acid 1 linked to amino acid 2 linked to amino acid 3, etc., etc. And DNA is responsible for the code that links these building blocks together. Type 1 collagen has a different series of amino acids in one part of it, a small part of it. Type 2 has another different set of amino acids part of the primary structure. So the primary structure varies slightly from the collagen one type to another. Advances in the last 40 years, I don't know if you call them advances or not, but now we recognize 25 different types of collagen, which has muddied the water. We used to be so simple. The fact is, we're going to simplify it. We're going to say, for our purposes, we only need to know something about those four classic types. And that's okay, because after four comes some very specialized types that knowing about them doesn't enhance our learning very much. And so if you look at Ross, you'll see all 25 types listed in table 6.2, and it's curious reading. But 1 through 4 is crucial to our understanding of the function of connective tissue. Collagen is an extracellular product. Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Can I go back to number 13?
Yeah.
When you were talking about the collagen fibers have elasticity.
Yeah.
So does that mean that they have elastic fibers in there?
No. The protein found in elastic fibers is a different protein than found in collagen fibers. And so the biological properties have a lot to do with those particular proteins. For example, the proteins in elastin can remodel themselves as you stretch them. But the protein in collagen has very little remodeling, so they can't be stretched very much at all.
So going to E, the type 4 collagen,
uh-huh.
So since it is found in the basal lamina, is that, as far as the structural properties, is it more tightly bound or less tightly bound in molecules?
Yeah, definitely exactly what you should be asking. That's the question you should be asking. Like you said, you have to know where each of these are, and that may or may not help you to understand their function. And we're talking about this one. This is the only collagen type that forms no fibrils. The collagen molecules are very tightly arranged. But the fibers, the collagen molecules I'm drawing here, don't line up to form a fibril. And that allows them to pack and form a much more denser mat than you see in collagen fibrils. So of these four types, 1, 2, and 3 will form fibrils, but 4 will not. So on F, the only thing I want to say now before the break is that since collagen is an extracellular protein, then where do you think the amino acids are linked together to make the collagen molecule then? Since collagen is an extracellular protein, where in the cell would you predict that the amino acids would be linked together? Question number 3 on the quiz, or... Question number 5 then, yeah. What organelle in the cell is responsible in the fibroblast for linking up amino acids to form a protein? Why was antibodies in plasma cells the correct answer for that question?
The protein
Yes, because protein made in the RER is used for export out of the cell. Exactly. In other words, you would predict from your knowledge of our previous discussions and your study that the rough endoplasmic reticulum of fibroblasts are the site of collagen manufacture. Now, as the amino acids are linked together, what organelle receives little baby collagen molecules for packaging? Golgi apparatus, and then they're secreted out of the cell. The DNA in the nucleus transcribes messenger RNA. It goes together by translation, and we have a slide coming up that summarizes all of that for you. I think we might, we're not quite ready for that slide yet, and we need to take a break. So the last item here, notice that about 30%, including water from your body, about 30% of your mass is collagen. That's a hurt, isn't it? The collagen molecules are made and secreted from the cell, and her question is, where are the fibers assembled outside the cell? Fibers form outside the cell. The idea of a boogert has to have a baby, and this huge 80-pound baby spitting out of you. So the babies, the fibers assembled outside of the cell. Let's take a break. Deciding why bricks are called lining. Anybody from UK here? Anybody spend some time in England? Why are bricks called limey? We're going to talk about it right now. Okay, we got four slides to talk about limey. Well, they're called limeys because British sailors during the Empire, during exploration, British sailors were called limeys. Now let's see why British sailors were called limeys. Anyway, before we do that, let's look at the relationship between molecules, fibrils, and fiber. And I got two slides to show that. One is from Juan Kiar's textbook, and the other one is from your textbook. And I look at both of them because each of them is incomplete in itself. And what's missing from Juan Kiar's is how collagen molecules, tropical collagen molecules, are put together, what their composition is. But we'll start with an individual molecule. It turns out that there's three polypeptide chains, and you can't see that here. And the tropical collagen molecule has a head end and a tail end. Let's call this the head end, and we'll call this the tail end. And in the formation of a fibril, which type 1 has, in the formation of a fibril, these collagen molecules line up side by side, as you see in the picture. Each molecule is about 280 nanometers in length and much, much smaller, 1.5 nanometers in diameter. But we don't care about that. It just means very tiny. And the heads don't touch the tails. There's kind of a hole region called the lacunar region, but I don't know why they have to use those. What's a foramen, by the way? A hole. A lacunar is a hole. So it's got a hole region there where the head and tails don't touch. And then there's an overlap period where the molecule out here, for example, overlaps this one, a small distance here, and you can see the overlapping region, about 10% of the length of the molecule. Well, these hole regions are regions where mineral can get deposited in bone, for bone to start mineralizing because of the space in there. But notice that the molecules line up side by side, but they stagger a little bit. It's called the overlap region. And there's different amino acids along the chain. Some are hydrophobic amino acids, some are sulfated amino acids, some are large amino acids, and some are glycine, little tiny amino acids. Every third amino acid in this collagen molecule is glycine. And so if you look at three amino acids in sequence, you'll see a lot of glycine, a lot of proline, and then the next one, any amino acid. So glycine, P stands for proline. There's about 20 different amino acids that make up our protein. And typically, the most important thing is that 33% of all amino acids in collagen molecules are glycine, very tiny little, which allows for the arrangement that we see here. The specific amino acid sequence is what provides for this lining up of molecules. Where does this happen? This happens outside the cell. The cell secretes the individual molecules, the individual black lines there, and then they self-assemble outside the cell. That's been somewhat of a mystery of how that happens for 100 years or more. Anyway, the fibril forms, both 2 and 3 are fibrils. You see, the fibrils have a repeating banding when stained with a heavy metal. And this banding pattern is described here as 640 angstroms, but most textbooks now have revised that to 680 angstroms, which means 68 nanometers, and I think one Chiara says 64. There's a disagreement on what exactly the spacing should be in the repeating period. This, remember that the length of the molecule is much greater than that. The length of the molecule is 280 nanometers, but the staining with a metal stain shows a repeating periodicity, and I'll show you that here in a second. Now these fibrils that have a banding pattern to them right here combine together, and here's one here, and it becomes that little thing there, and maybe that one. And so these fibrils aggregate side by side in type 1 collagen and type 3 collagen, type 1 collagen and type 3 collagen, to form a fiber, which you see in the lab as a eosinophilic pink structure, thread, fiber. Now, what is Juan Chiara trying to illustrate here? Well, he's trying to illustrate that if you add these fibers together, fiber 1, fiber 2, fiber 3, fiber 4, and you put all these fibers side by side, you get what he calls a bundle. Well, that's not good. I don't like that. If you have, if this is a type 1 collagen we're talking about, this type 1 collagen, and everything you see there is building a type 1 collagen fiber, and these type 1 fibers all line up side by side, then we have, as you saw in the lab, something called tendon. Well, you see many of those in gross anatomy class. I got lots of them to show you here. Right hand, one tendon. Now I can visualize by closing my eyes, I can visualize the composition of that tendon. I can visualize that it's made up of multiple collagen fibers. And each fiber is made up of multiple fibrils, and each fibril is made up of individual molecules. Obviously, I'm not using the microscope, I'm just visualizing what I see in my tendon.
What about ligaments?
Ligaments, the collagen fibers most of the time do not line up side by side, because the tendon, we need the fiber side by side because we have to direct the force in a very specific direction. Ligaments, on the other hand, have to direct the force in many different directions. And so it's not useful to line the fibers up side by side. So this would really only be a tendon. Here, this one.
They're both made up of collagen
fibers. Both made up of collagen fibers, yep.
It would just be like fibers, but
instead of lining them up, they're more randomly arranged. So there would be dense, irregular connective tissue, and a tendon is what? dense regular connective tissue. Ligament, dense irregular, because the fibers don't line up side by side. So here's those fibrils seen with the electron microscope, and you can see the metal staining shows a cross-banded appearance, black, light, black, white, black, white, black, white band. And if I pick on this band right there, and I go down and find it again right there, and I find it again right there, and I find it again right there, and again right there, and I measure the distance right in here, it's going to be what? 68 nanometers, or 64 if you're lucky, or 64, 68 nanometers, a repeating banding pattern across that fibril that you cannot see with a light microscope. Only see with the electron microscope. What's going on over here? The fibrils are what? Running the other way. And you're looking at cross-sections of the fibers. Cross-sections over on the right, longitudinal sections on the left. The banding pattern is created by heavy metal that's deposited on the amino acid, binding to the amino acid. I'll show you that in a second. This is type 3 for sure. I was going to get to that right now, actually. This is type 3. We were talking about type 1. This is type 3, where the individual fibrils are very tiny, and they all are the same diameter. And this is the collagen that makes up reticular fibers. There's a lot of sugar in there, in association with those fibers. On the surface of the fibril, this fiber from here to there, that fiber made up of all those fibrils could be stained with silver and show up as a reticular fiber that you saw in lab, or if you haven't seen in lab yet, I hope that little black pinky thing made up of all those little fibrils. And type 3 collagen, the fibrils are small, they're all of equal diameter, and they stain in light microscopy with silver to form a reticular fiber. Here is type 1 collagen fibril. Notice that they're big and husky, some of them anyway. The most important point is they're of different diameters, not of the same diameter. But they still have the same, periodicity or banding pattern. Between those two lines there is approximately 68 nanometers. Based upon the orientation of the individual molecules and how the amino acids stain from one molecule to the next molecule. Type 1 collagen fibers are the fibers, well, these are the fibrils, but when they aggregate to form a fiber, a type 1 fiber, those are the fibers that you see in conventional H&E preparations as the pink object that streaks through the field of view. And if your slide is stained with H&E, the only fibers you will see are type 1 collagen fibers. Every collagen fiber you see is type 1. If they're stained with silver, then you will be able to distinguish which of those are reticular fibers. Otherwise, you can't. So we're going to assume that every pink fiber you see is type 1 collagen. And then that's okay, because the type 1 collagen makes up the bulk of our connective tissue collagen. Most of it is type 1 collagen. And here's Ross's illustration of this. The fibril is here. Well, what's it composed of? It's composed of molecules that line up side by side. Now, how about this one molecule here? Now, this is new information now. How about this molecule here, indicated by that line? Well, it's made up of three polypeptide chains that wrap around each other in a right-handed helix. Each molecule, indicated previously by a dark line, is actually three protein chains in an alpha helix formation, meaning that each chain has a clockwise right-handed twist around each other. And you can see it at high mag here as you're looking at that collagen molecule. This one here has a right-handed corkscrew helical twist to it. One-third of the molecules are glycine. One here, and one here. I promised this slide here to summarize collagen synthesis. It utilizes information that you should be fairly comfortable with at this point now, and that's this process of transcription and translation. And the relationship between rough ER and Golgi apparatus. And so let's use this as a model to test what you know about transcription and translation. So we can begin with nutrients available to the cell. Amino acids that have come from our food through the bloodstream and are depositing in the tissue space so that fibroblasts have access to food. And the important ingredients for our discussion are amino acids like proline, lysine, glycine, and so forth. Well, the transcription occurs in the nucleus where the DNA transcribes messenger RNA. And This transcription provides a messenger RNA that has to wiggle its way through the nuclear pores and get out into the cytosol. And then, of course, it finds its way to ribosomes on the rough ER. And that's occurring right here from 3 to 5. Is occurring in the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And so steps three through five we'll call translation then, as the messenger RNA code is translated on the ribosomes of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Now, collagen has some unique features about its synthesis because during this translation process, some of the proline amino acids are hydroxylated, OH proline. That's kind of unique in protein synthesis. Very unique, as a matter of fact. And so this new amino acid, in fact it's called an amino acid, is called hydroxyproline. And some of the lysine residues are hydroxylated, called hydroxylysine. This all happens in the rough ER. So we have now formed a collagen molecule that is passed to the next level of the Golgi apparatus right here. So here's the transfer vesicles carrying the hydroxylated tropocollagen molecules to the Golgi apparatus here, and it's doing its thing, and pretty soon it's going to secrete it out here into the extracellular space. Well, this hydroxylation process cannot occur. Let me rephrase that. This hydroxylation process is required for that collagen to move to the next step. The hydroxylation of proline and the hydroxylation of lysine is required for that molecule to leave the cell, to move on to the next step. The hydroxylation process requires vitamin C for that to happen. And if vitamin C is deficient, then the fibroblasts will engorge themselves with collagen and will die because they can't secrete it out of the cell. When this happened, when this vitamin C deficiency happened in the British Empire with the British sailors exploring the world, when this happened, their teeth fell out, and their tendons got weak, and their ligaments got weak. And when their teeth fell out, they got infections and died. And this condition is called scurvy. And so why are they called limeys? Because they took limes on board. And what's in limes? Vitamin C. Vitamin C in limes prevented scurvy, and now you know the rest of the story. Who's that guy? Paul Harvey, you don't know Paul. Gosh, you guys are so young. There we go. Thanks, Diane. Paul Harvey. What's necessary in the proper synthesis of collagen is vitamin C for the hydroxylation. And so this was one of the first functions described for vitamin C. Was collagen synthesis. So if you want to have good wound healing, if you have a laceration or whatever kind of wound that's healing, do you want to take vitamin C? Yeah, because collagen is scar tissue. And if you're vitamin C deficient and you're trying to heal a wound, there's no scar then, and there's no strength to that wound. So it's vastly important to part of our physiology to have this particular vitamin for that job. Some of the hydroxylysine residues, have a lot of carbohydrate on them. And the more carbohydrate we have, the more likely that we're talking about type 4 collagen. Type 4 collagen in basement membranes has a lot of hydroxylysine that has a lot of carbohydrate in it, and that particular fact presumably prevents those molecules in becoming fibrous. It can't light up, form fiber. Type 3 collagen is the collagen we find in reticular fibers. Type 2 collagen is the collagen we find in cartilage. Type 2 collagen is the collagen of cartilage. Type 1 collagen is the most common type that you're going to be looking at. You will not see a fiber in cartilage because the fibrils cannot aggregate to form fibers. So you're not likely to see a collagen fiber in cartilage. All you see is a homogeneous pink or blue background. No evidence of fibers. Type 2 collagen will not form fibers because of its chemistry. Well, let's move to elastic fibers then. If you look at the slide in the lab and you decided that you're looking at cartilage, then what are you going to do to determine what kind of cartilage? Well, there's three types of cartilage. Hyaline, elastic cartilage, and fibrocartilage. Hyaline, elastic, and fibrocartilage. Hyaline cartilage shows no fibers. How might you recognize elastic cartilage? Would it have any fibers in it? May or may not. What do you think? Yes, it has elastic fibers in it. The elastic fibers we showed in the early slides, those little tiny thin lines. Here's another complication for you to keep straight, and that is that you cannot see elastic fibers unless you have a special stain for them. You can't see reticular fibers unless you have a proper stain for them. Reticular fiber stain with a silver or heavy metal, elastic fiber stain with a whole bunch of different. If the slide is not stained for reticular elastic, you will not see them. That's true for elastic cartilage. If you have some cartilage that's not stained for elastic fiber, you might think it's hyaline cartilage. Hyaline cartilage is cartilage that has no fibers whatsoever. Hyaline cartilage, type 2 collagen, no fibers in it. Elastic cartilage has type 2 collagen in it, but it's got elastic fibers in it.
Can you spell that?
Hyaline, H-Y-A-L-I-N-E, hyaline. So let's talk about elastic fibers for a second. They are found in almost any place in the body. And they're on the skin. I can pull on them here and let go, and it goes back up. In the lungs, the reason why the lungs will allow you to breathe out is because the elastic fibers in your lung recoil, the lung shrinks down, and the air passes out of your nose. So what are these elastic fibers? Well, they're composed of multiple proteins. Collagen fibers are primarily collagen with a little bit of carbohydrate. So collagen is really a glycoprotein, but we ignore that. Elastic fibers, far more complicated. Their core is a very special protein called elastin, which endows them, these fibers, with their characteristics of recoil, stretch and recoil. We're not going to get into the elastin chemistry here, and I'm not sure you will ever talk about the chemistry of elastin, but it's just one of the proteins. The other class of proteins is called fibrillin. And there are several different types of this protein. It's a glycoprotein. Fibrillin is the name given for another group of proteins in elastic fibers. Very complicated compared to collagen fibers. These fibrillin molecules arrange themselves into a microscopically visible object called the microfibril. Microfibril is a structure. Fibrillin is a chemical. Don't get them confused. Fibrillin is a protein substance, and microfibril is something that the electron microscope sees. But the point is that the electron microscope shows these double-stranded filaments, like this one here. They're about 10 nanometers in diameter. And these little banded filaments are not collagen fibrils. They're not composed of collagen molecules. They're composed of a different protein called fibrillin. And these microfibrils are a component of elastic fibers. And here you can see the fibrils cut in cross-section. Makes them look like little rings. That is this fiber here, cut in cross-section, going right bang across there, looking at the cut end of the fibril. And the elastin is specially stained here to show up as a homogeneous black. Even with the electron microscope, you need a special stain to show elastin. And please look for elastic fibers in the slides, and the only way you'll really see them is if they're stained with a special stain. Locations of elastic fibers are on almost any organ everywhere. Oh, that reminds me. Which organ in the body has none of this stuff? Has no collagen fiber, no elastic fiber, no fibrils, no reticular fiber, no fibroblast, has no connective tissue in it. What organ is that?
Brain.
Brain has none of that. Has no connective tissue in it. So if we take out a brain that somebody that has just recently passed away and we put that brain on the tabletop, what will it look like? A little puddle of jello. J-E-L-L-O. Jello. And so it doesn't look at all like he's pictured on t-shirts, my brain on drugs, you know, that sort of thing. It doesn't look like that at all. It settles down into a tiny little puddle of jello. Unless it's fixed with formalin, of course, and it's hard. So there's some elastic fibers that have been stained in the dermis of the skin. And the dermis of our skin is loaded with elastic fibers. They disappear with age. Older individuals don't have much recoil in their skin anymore. Look at the collagen fibers. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger there. That's the big, tough, you can't fool with a collagen fiber kind of thing. It doesn't stretch much. It has high tensile strength, and it produces a strength in wounds and wound healing. Here's a picture I took with the electron microscope. Here's a fibroblast down here, the fibroblast nucleus. Here's a collagen fibril, a type 1 collagen fibril. Here's another one over here. That's a tiny one. How did I know that this was type 1 collagen? Because the collagen fibrils are of different diameters. And there's a cross-section of an elastic fiber. The elastin doesn't stain because I didn't use the stain for it. The microfibrils show up nicely there. Here's a longitudinal cut. Here's a collagen fiber running this way. And here's an elastic fiber running this way. And the elastin is white, and the microfibrils on the outside look like little tiny double-stranded filaments, and that's where the fibrillin is located. We have a disease, the fibrillin, that we'll talk about. It's a genetic disease. It's inherited as autosomal dominant inherited disease. And so if you carry the gene you got from mom or dad, you will have some symptoms of defective fibrillin, of defective microfibrils. This stuff, microfibrils, is found even in the absence of elastin. They don't always pal up. They don't always combine together to form that. And the microfibrils that I'm thinking of, the best example, are the microfibrils that hold the lens of your eye in position. And the microfibrils change the shape of your lens from fat to skinny, and from skinny to fat, which I can do right now, maybe, by looking way off in the distance, and my lens is flat. Looking here, and my lens is fat. And these microfibrils in the eye are responsible, along with the muscle, in changing the shape of your lens so you can adapt from far to near vision. These people with the disease, the lens dislocates and floats around in the eye. Dislocated lens is a very common feature of the condition I'm talking about. There's a defective gene on chromosome 15 that codes for fibrillin. And fibrillin is defective, and so the lens of their eye becomes dislocated and floats around. Elastic fibers are a problem, and connective tissue in general is a problem because microfibrils are found everywhere, and you can't see them with a light microscope. They're found everywhere. They thought that Abraham Lincoln had this disease, and the shape of his fingers and his hands and all the pictures that he had, it looked exactly like Marfan syndrome. M-A-R-F-A-N-S, Marfan syndrome, is a genetic disease of defective fibrillin, and it affects almost all connective tissue. The worst case scenario is the effect that it has on the elastic fibers of the aorta, causing a severe, in worst case scenario, severe severe damage to the aorta. I guess what I'm trying to say is that even though microfibrils are something that can't be seen with the light microscope, we know that they're there, and there are far more conditions than just Marfan syndrome that result from... Do you know anybody with Marfan syndrome? We had a student here about 3-4 years ago that had Marfan's. You'll encounter it in some time during your career, I'm sure. Okay. We're not getting as far as about reticular fibers. We talked a little bit about cartilage. I think what I'd like to... Yeah, we don't have time. I think what we'll do in lab is orient you to cartilage, if you haven't already been oriented to cartilage, in laboratory, and that'll solve that problem there. Let's finish up with this. We only have a few minutes anyway, a couple minutes there. Reticular fibers need a special stain to be seen. Their composition is primarily type 3 collagen and a lot of carbohydrate. These fibers, again, almost like microfibrils, are found in almost every organ, but they're highly concentrated in lymph node and spleen and bone marrow. They're highly concentrated in organs that you oftentimes think of as immune organs, lymph node, spleen, bone marrow, tonsils. And here's lymph node. And the reticular fibers are stained with a heavy metal, probably silver. They're a little wavy, aren't they? Kind of kinky. Here's some more of them. Little black threads. If the stain wasn't used, then you would not see them. Some of the cells that are found in connective tissue, the most important, of course, is fibroblast, and it makes all the collagen, all the elastin, all the proteoglycans, all the glycoproteins, all the fibronectin, everything found in the connective tissue is made by fibroblasts. They may take on two configurations. This is the type we see most often, where the cells are kind of squished and very flat. When they're having a blast, however, then we see a lot of rough ER and a lot of cellular activity. But when they're quiet, when they're not busy making collagen or other, then they resort to something you might call a fibrocyte, but it's not having a blast right now. It will later when it's time. So they can revert the morphology kind of back and forth there. They're found throughout the connective tissue, and here's some really nice fibroblasts with their long arms sticking out, from the body here like this. And they're trucking through there, see? They do move as well. Do move. And look at the long process there on that cell. Another cell, maybe the last one we'll get to talk about, is one we've already referred to before. And what does this word mean, the macrophage?
Big eater.
And it's a defense cell, isn't it? Which can eat up bacteria, can eat up dead necrotic heart cells, darn it, and other kinds of cancer cells that can eat things that are not good for us and we need to get rid of them. So phagocytosis is the function, and lysosomal digestion, and the arrow's pointing at a lysosome. Some of these are secondary lysosomes. Some of them are primary. They look very ragged and angry on their edges when they're busy. When they're actively doing something, they have this angry pattern appearance. Their hair sticking out all over, and they remind me of Mr. Hyde, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde convergence. Because when they're Dr. Jekyll, they look very dignified. They have a little tie on. Very smooth and dignified. You can't hardly see the lysosomes. And then they're in your bloodstream then. And they're called a monocyte at that time. And no one knows by looking at a monocyte that they are secretly natural-born killer. As soon as they leave the bloodstream, they form this ugly, bad-tempered army recruit. Fat cells are... There's another macrophage. Look how angry it looks. Taking up everything in the vicinity, and it wants to kill, kill, kill. There. Here's a fat cell seen with a scanning microscope. Ooh, those nasty little buggers there. And these are reticular fibers that hold them together. So when you look at adipose tissue in the lab, just imagine that each of those fat cells, which are really easy to see, are held together by reticular fibers. Why can't you see them in the slides in the lab? Why can't you see the reticular fibers?
You're not
stained for it. Otherwise, you'd see, otherwise in that fat, you'd see this stuff get there. Okay. We have to stop here. Sorry. Oh, we almost got the target. Oh, close.